Welcome to episode 5 of the People Stack podcast, where we discuss the intersection of people, work, and technology. I'm your host, Jen Bunk, founder of Jen Bunk Ventures and creator of People Stack Academy, an online school dedicated to helping the tech community build a better people stack. My co-host is my husband, Rob Allen.
Hello.
He's engineering manager at RBM Technologies. Hi, Rob. And our guest for this episode is Ben Bach, who is founder of Bebach.co. Welcome, Ben. Welcome, Rob.
Hey, Jen. Hey, Rob.
Hey, Ben.
So just by way of kind of introduction for our listeners so that everybody knows how we all know one another, Ben was actually a student in one of my classes at Westchester University of Pennsylvania where Ben received his master's in IO psychology. So I was his professor. But now we've kind of changed roles where we're both kind of venturing into the tech entrepreneurial world. So it's very cool that we can reconnect in kind of a different way, but already knowing one another through our classroom interactions. So I think that's kind of cool to be able to do that. So Ben, why don't you start out by telling us just a little bit about your business and what you do?
Sure. I think it's important to kind of provide context as it relates to my background in technology prior to making the jump entrepreneurially to launch my own brand. So I operated a startup incubator in Westchester over the last couple of years called Walnut Street Labs. And it was definitely an interesting experience. And frankly, it provided me an opportunity for growth and learning that far exceeded if I were to jump into a major corporate hierarchy at the bottom, because I was able to have a large degree of strategic impact in the choices that we made, and therefore perhaps a much larger feeling of responsibility when the project didn't fully pan out. There were other individuals in my team, and certainly I don't carry the brunt of the burden, but most people coming out of grad school, I don't think, deal right away with the prospects of bankruptcy and kind of larger things that maybe aren't addressed to the extent that they could be in school. So that's some context. I worked with entrepreneurs and really got inspired by entrepreneurs for the last couple of years. And since then, since being laid off, I was forced to consider, what I'm most passionate about. And part of my previous role was really broadcasting and promoting the beauty of loving what you do to the extent that you're willing to make serious compromises personally as well as professionally to see your dreams manifest. So for me, it was really important to get into a place that emphasized wellness as it relates to IO psychology, but even more specifically, self-actualization. So helping to optimize self-talk so that it increases self-love and self-care, but also that individual mindfulness and consciousness or awareness of the self in a positive and constructive context would further strengthen the social interactions that we have in the workplace. So Bebach.co is kind of a larger umbrella for which a variety of different offerings are being built. And one of them, which is the primary one as of right now, it's called Mindful Voyager, and I go into yogic communities, so places where there's already kind of a pre-established foundation for mindfulness, and I do workshops. I'm also doing a end-of-life and mindfulness workshop with a Quaker community, a friend's meeting house, and I'm also going into fairly large, middle-sized tech companies to larger tech companies and offering a somewhat third-partied wellness program that's emphasizing specifically mindfulness in the workplace and positive intelligence, which is a new metric for self-awareness.
All right. So I'm going to take a huge step back and make the assumption that some of our listeners may understand a little bit about what mindfulness is. Some may not know anything about mindfulness, and some people may have some misconceptions about mindfulness. So Rob's actually raising his hand over there. So I've talked, Rob, about mindfulness a little bit, but would you be able to define what mindfulness is, Rob?
Not well, no.
Okay. All right.
I'm sure Ben can.
Yeah. So, no, right. So I'm trying to prove a point. Okay. So, yeah. So, Ben, what is mindfulness?
Okay. So, conversationally, people refer to the verb to be mindful without knowing the full extent of the competencies associated with the actual meditation practice. But when we're talking about being mindful, it embodies a variety of competencies. So when people say, I need to be more mindful, generally they're using that term to relate to consciousness, or they're using it as a synonym for consciousness. But it's important to recognize, as it relates to the practice of mindfulness, that mindfulness is not synonymous with consciousness. Mindfulness helps to expand consciousness, but the two are not one and the same.
So when you're using consciousness there, Ben, do you mean the mental act of paying attention to, or do you mean consciousness in that we have a consciousness as human beings in general?
That's a great question. It is very much related to who's saying it and in what context. We are conscious beings because we have a prefrontal cortex that's capable of making a number of different decisions, and also weighing the weight, the checks and balances, the ramifications for those choices. So we have the ability to distinguish what we should do in a certain situation. But primarily, when I'm talking about consciousness versus mindfulness, I'm talking about self-awareness and the manifestations of self-awareness. So mindfulness encompasses an observational focus, meaning that for most of our lives, we unconsciously react to our world around us, rather than taking a step back and observing situations. We easily attach judgments to the quality of those happenings. So when something happens, naturally our brains are programmed to react in a way that we've been trained is the best response, or the most natural response. Mindfulness is an opportunity. This is kind of one of the competencies of observance, to take a step back and allow an observational focus to provide a greater awareness or perspective on something that is happening, rather than attaching an immediate neurochemical response that generally is motivated by fear. One of the overarching competencies to mindfulness is a fairly heady, piece of psychobabble called decoupling the ego. And what it really means is detaching our sense of self, our confidence, or love from our external world. A good example is that when something happens and we attribute it to our own sense of self, it causes a virtual or a synthetic inflation of our confidence or self-love. So when the opposite occurs, we feel bad. We feel deflated. And in the process, we attach our feelings of ourselves to external stimuli. So in the process of removing or reclaiming self-love as inherent to the self, we're able to go throughout our lives without the need to thrive off of that external validation. So that's huge. That's a big fundamental piece. So becoming aware of what is in the mind while breathing in a relaxed, non-reactive based state.
And I think to me, from what I know about mindfulness, it's the non-reactive piece of it that is really key, because otherwise it's just being, right? I'm here, I'm paying attention to stuff, right? There's that, and then there's paying attention, but not judging, not attaching anything positive or negative or telling or attaching negative self-talk, for example, to something that might have happened to you, that it is, so it is, so we move on. That's kind of a way that I see it, that this happened to me. It's neither positive nor negative. What's that thought? That quote, that it's nothing is either good nor bad. It's thinking that makes it so. I know I totally probably butchered that quote, but it's thinking that makes something positive or negative. And so to me, that's like at the heart of what mindfulness is, and detaching yourself from that. So that non-reactive piece of it.
Totally.
So this is actually really good timing for me to talk about mindfulness, because I am actually right now in the middle of a 2-day workshop it's a self-development workshop. It's about becoming a more excellent person, becoming a better version of yourself. A key part of it is talking about mindfulness and non-judgment. We actually, one of the co-facilitators took us through a meditation practice today, a guided meditation. So this is very front of mind for me right now. And so one of the other things that's front of mind for me in terms of thinking of making connections between all of this mindfulness stuff and what I'm trying to do is along the lines of, and maybe Rob, if you can give some thoughts on this, how do you think folks in your company, yourself included, would respond to the idea of going through some sort of mindfulness training or learning how to meditate, or just in general, understanding the benefits of being more mindful in your life?
There's within our engineering group, there'd be maybe 15% who would be aware of the practice already and thus down for it. There's probably another 20% that'll say, yeah, what the hell, is there going to be pizza?
Uh-huh.
And then there's another 65%, if I've done my math correctly, who would probably not be overly interested at all and closer toward the cynical waste of my time side.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Just spitballing.
Right. Yeah. So Ben, how do you deal with the cynicism?
That's a good question. I think the first aspect, just so that I'm embodying the stuff that I'm really trying to facilitate, is recognizing that not everyone is going to be, open to new practices and neurological patterns that, frankly, confront a lot of aspects of the ego or the false ego that maybe they don't want to confront. So rigidity is a major gatekeeper. It's a major obstacle in pitching this to anyone. And therefore, once my foot's in the door and I'm working with a program, I'm working on a program or with a group of people, resistance within the group itself is inevitable. The clearest path for me as an alleviator of rigidity or one's own preconceived notions is to eliminate misconception. That would be number one. And number two is to provide a clearly accessible program that is simple and effective and provides almost immediate potent opportunities for people to experience the depth and importance and value that these programs offer. But like anything, going through life, there has to be an openness to experience life and new aspects of life, new ways of looking at life, in order to enjoy the benefits. So only so much of it is within my own ability. And then beyond that, I kind of have to let go to, what other people think and feel.
Yeah, so I was going to ask how you demonstrate the ROI, of mindfulness to say a potential CEO of a company or whoever a potential client might be. But it sounds like the approach that you're taking is you're looking for people, like the ideal client partners for you would be the people who already see that. That if they don't, then maybe they're not the best people to receive this kind of potential transformation. So do you ever have to make the ROI argument, or is it kind of just, yeah, I get it, tell me more about it, how much is it, you know, that kind of thing? How do you go about that sort of that pitch, that salesy kind of piece of it that is a necessary part of owning, of having your own business?
Yeah, especially as it relates to kind of the academic background that you come from and that I am just beginning to get to know better. Metrics are huge because it provides quantifiable measurements. You know, there is an outcome in finite, dualistic means to establish the effectiveness of something. And it kind of goes into a larger, more philosophical discussion, but there is a serious need to establish qualitative as well as quantitative measurements for people's experiences. I agree. I generally am looking for people who really see the value of meditation in the workplace at a fairly holistic level, to the extent that selling them is, you know, kind of the most minimal, requires the most minimal effort, because there are a lot of people out there that maybe just don't understand it at all. And I'm not at the place within my own business that I have the time to you know, convert people, as it were, or evangelize to roughly.
Yeah, I have a couple of people in mind that I am sure will put up a substantial barrier to spending time on such things. And these are folks who really just want to get through their day so they can go home.
Yeah.
And sadly, those are the people who need it the most, because those are the people who are stuck on the treadmill of do, go to sleep, do, go to sleep, without really thinking about, like, who am I? Right? What? Why am I here? What? That kind of thing. So you don't think that they're like that?
I don't know that that's necessarily the case. I think they have rich and meaningful lives, but that the job that they're doing right now is not the most enriching part of that particular life. So many of these guys, so they have kids who play sports and they want to be there for the kids' sports. Mm-hmm. And the you know, one of them's got a daughter going off to college after the end of this year. And so this is the last year he gets to go see her do her things in high school. And so he wants to be there for that. So he tries to check out around 3:30 or so every day. But in order for him to do that and do that responsibly, he needs to get through his work in as efficient a manner as possible.
Sure. So in reference to this being sold as an offering, wellness program, or, you know, like a third-party kind of HR gig, it's also life enrichment, essentially, because these practices, despite being packaged to a professional milieu, it transcends that. It's about getting all of the juices and divine experiences out of life as possible. And I just wanted to speak to that, to those individuals or those people who maybe feel like, I don't really want to invest my time or resources into a program at work because I have other things that I value to be more important. But if they're paying attention, I guess, as these competencies are the introductory part of these this package, they can actually enjoy those moments with their children, or those moments enjoying their hobbies more clearly because of these competencies. One of the competencies for mindfulness is called present moment orientation. Are you guys familiar with what that means or what that entails and how that relates to quality of life?
I am not, so please explain.
Okay, so when we go through life, and especially in the West, because it's how we've been raised and it's what we've been born into, we spend most of our time looking towards the future with some anxiety, palpable stress. And we also lament in the past. There's certainly moments of nostalgia that bring blissful sensations, and there's a lot of good, and there's certainly good in organizing or planning goals for the future. But we spend a very small amount of time in the moment of our lives and actually living our lives while it's happening, while it's unfolding. The onslaught of technology is a great example for a utility that has, you know, such a vast potential for growth in our civilization, but it also can pull us away from experiencing this third dimensional reality because of its virtual nature. And even now, we're using its virtual nature to get together in a third dimensional context.
That's right.
And so there is utility, and it's just a matter of how you use it. But for this gentleman who, the example you gave, has a daughter who's leaving for college, and he wants to just soak up every moment. Well, he could be spending time with his daughter, and he could be stressing out about work and ruining his chances of soaking up the last moments that he's going to have with his daughter before his daughter goes off to college and, you know, for lack of a better term, becomes a woman, or, you know, comes into her own adulthood. So despite this, you know, being packaged as a work offering, it's something that really is more about work-life balance than just productivity at work.
So shifting gears just a little bit, talking still about work, but more specifically about our work as entrepreneurs and our work as folks within the tech industry. So Ben, you said something earlier on that I wrote down that I'm a big fan of great quotes, and I think this, I'm going to call it a Ben Bach great quote. You said something along the lines of that we make serious compromises in order to see our dreams manifest. And I think that that very much typifies the experience of an entrepreneur, and to some extent, somebody who's working for a tech startup like with Rob. So, Rob, did that strike a chord with you that we're making compromises in order to see our dreams manifest, both for you personally, but also like for RBM as a company and your experience with your team?
I want to say yes, but I'd be hard pressed to point them out.
The compromises.
Yeah. So it was a lot easier before when it wasn't a tech startup, but a larger tech company. It was the compromises were more salient and therefore more impactful. The compromises I'm making now, I mean, aside from sort of little micro compromises that we make with every decision that involves a client, they feel a lot larger in the moment, but when you step back, you realize, you know, they're not so big after all. But you take all of those on balance and they, what do they add up to? I don't really know. But yeah, I don't, if there's huge compromises right now, I'm not seeing it.
But it's the small ones add up, right? Yeah.
Possibly. Yeah, it's, I don't know what they amount to though.
Yeah. So I'm gonna turn that back on you and your business, Ben. To what extent do you see that sort of being true to your business that you've been need to make compromises in order to eventually see the eventual success?
I would say the major one, and I imagine this resonates with you, which is just the prospects of getting started can seem pretty massive. Like anything, you know, the lab took a lot of work, a lot of sweat equity, a lot of time and energy that I didn't get paid for to make stuff happen and to build a community of innovation in the suburbs, you know, of all places. And with Mindful Voyager and Bebok.co, it's just kind of going back to the drawing board and reaching out to the hundreds of people that I met over the last couple of years and say, hey, do you remember me? I'm the guy with the long hair and the big holes in his ears. who wants to work in corporate America teaching people meditation.
Yeah.
To be honest, if you're going to teach corporate America mindful meditation, you need to have the long hair and the holes in the ears.
Yeah, thank you.
It's
thank you, Rob.
It's part of the branding.
That means a lot. That means a lot, yeah. And I certainly am not interested in marginalizing myself more than I have to, but... You know, for lack of a better term, you have to really be vulnerable.
Yes,
you have to go out on a limb, and that's a tall order for most people. I'm really grateful for a lot of things that I learned from my last job, and I imagine both you, Jen and Rob, have previous experiences and lessons that you've learned throughout life, but even maybe more recently from your previous job, even were opportunities for growth that were totally close and closely applicable to your current position. And for me, coming from the lab, one of the major missions of the lab for our own team, so that we could grow and do something that was really kick-ass, was getting out of your comfort zone. And that's hard to do.
Yeah, and I think that's definitely one of the things that they're stressing in the workshop that I'm going through right now, that what separates you from greatness, what separates you from an excellent life, is in becoming comfortable with discomfort, that you need to be a little bit uncomfortable, and that if you are, that means you're doing something right. So that really resonated with me. So Ben, in terms of thinking back on your training in IO psychology, to what extent has it helped or hindered what you're doing now? And actually, just for those folks who are new listeners, IO psychology is short for industrial organizational psychology. And it's essentially psychology applied to the business world. So take anything that's within the realm of psychology, if it applies to business, it's fair game for IO. So it's a lot of HR, but it's also a lot of motivation and leadership and, you know, thinking about how we work at work as people. So going back to the question, Ben, how have you tied in or not tied in your training in IO psychology and your current pursuits?
That's a good question. I feel like if I didn't enroll in this program and graduate from Westchester with this degree, I don't think I would have ended up where I did, or you know, ultimately ended up where I am now, because I was looking for an internship. And frankly, like all of the corporate prospective corporate places that I interviewed at really didn't want me. It was palpable, and that didn't feel good, but it pushed me towards a community of people that I was already interested in, and it gave me that focus to go into startups. And I would say that IO has helped me primarily, in kind of both perspectives, from a macro business to a micro business, because I really am a people person. I'm a Gemini. I'm like a big communicator. I have like some pretty clairvoyant abilities to like see how people experience their lives and relate that in their own communication to others. So when someone's having a bad day, I can really see it, and I can really see how it affects their relationships within work and so on. So that psychological component, that humanistic component that relates to the fact that we met much of us on the planet Earth work for a living. And then on a higher level, a lot of the organizational strategy stuff, the stuff that's most intuitive to me, through the academic part of my life, I think is the stuff that I really took with me. The statistical analysis stuff, frankly, I think the program that I was in was somewhat archaically structured towards the kind of last step in technology, which was hand computations of suggesting metrics and processing the effectiveness of treatments, knowing full well that there was a program that would take care of all of this in a couple clicks. So I felt like getting to know the software better is something I still would like to discover. And, you know, who knows, maybe I can do some continuing ed stuff with SPSS or whatever the newest iteration of it is. But I think it's all served me, and I don't know if there's any, I don't think there's any really negative things that prevented me from learning or growing. But yeah, I've always been interested in psychology, so I feel like applying, you know, or learning more of an applied form of psychology seemed like a very useful thing.
Yeah, and I'm glad to hear that. And I think that my experience stepping out of the academic role has been very similar, that the thing that people seem to be most intrigued by, or at least one of the things that people seem intrigued by when I tell them my story and what I'm doing and my background, is, oh, IO psychology, what's that? Oh, that's really interesting. And, you know, so, oh, wow, that's cool. And so it's sort of like putting it all together for them. And you could see, like, some people are just like, oh, yeah, oh, it's HR, whatever. Yeah, they don't want to know any more of it. Yeah. Like, even though we know that it is different than HR and human resources. But other people, like, I really see, like, the eyes light up and the wheels start turning, like, oh, wow, like HR plus psychology? Oh my God, that's so cool. Tell me more. You know, and so that's where I really get to geek out and explain more about my background and like the science behind it, because I think that's really where we can really get a leg up in it. And so, Ben, to what extent do you talk about like the science behind like mindfulness and the science behind like meditation and that kind of thing?
I think it's huge, and I try to reference it as much as possible. Neuroplasticity is something that is pretty socially acceptable by now, meaning that it's commonplace. People might not, if you get a group of 10 people together, they might not all know of neuroplasticity, but when you explain it to them, it's probably intuitive enough that they could understand the nature that the brain is capable of consciously expanding, and that taking it a step further, making choices in our lives to better ourselves helps to rewire our brain so that we're, you know, making the best choices and that we're enjoying life to its fullest extent. So I try to rope in as much neuroscience as possible. And for IO, the benefits of MBSR, of mindfulness-based stress reduction, it's just, they're endless. There's physiological one, there's emotional benefits, there's psychological benefits, there's, you know, sociological benefits. There's so many benefits. So that doesn't hurt.
Yeah, and studies have shown this. But if you say, if you backtrack, like 20 years ago, there was nothing. There was maybe like one or two studies that people were like, oh no, that wasn't a good enough journal, or that study was terrible. But now it's like study after study after study are showing all of these benefits to it, which I think is just it's just a wonderful thing that it's finally catching on in the quote unquote mainstream, to the extent that you have companies that are offering these sort of mindfulness/wellness programs as part of what they're doing, as part of their corporate wellness programs. And the company that I'm at during this seminar, this 2-day seminar, they have a meditation room, which I think is just the coolest thing. And it's like prime real estate too. Like, this is a financial district, downtown Boston. They're on the 9th floor in its corner office. Right. So this would be like prime real estate for like the CEO or some CXO to say, yeah, that's my office. And they're like, no. We're going to make this prime real estate a meditation room. And so that is just direct evidence that this is catching on, and people are seeing the benefits of it. So I think that's very cool to see that kind of manifesting itself, that the research is actually feeding the practice and is actually happening in real life. All right, we're just about up on time. Is there anything else you wanted to add, Ben, before we wrap it up for the night?
Yeah, you did a great job facilitating, and in the effort or the spirit of kind of having a discussion, maybe it'll be nice to turn the tables on you and ask you one of the questions you asked me. So in that you're kind of establishing your own brand and maybe confronted by some of the content marketing challenges that we talked about earlier, what are the largest opportunities for growth for you personally and professionally as you enter into entrepreneurship?
Yeah, that's a great question. Yeah, thank you for turning the tables. I think that the opportunities for growth for me are just in terms of really getting the message out there. And so we talked about stepping outside of your comfort zone, and this is very much stepping outside of my comfort zone for myself, that it's entering into the marketing zone. You know, congratulations, you're a marketer now. You know, I feel like 80% of my time right now is spent, you know, when I spend it on my business, when I spend it on the PeopleStack stuff, it's in some form of marketing. And when, you know, in my previous life as an academic, I always thought of marketing and sales as like as evil. Oh, they're trying to sell to you. They're trying to manipulate your mind to try to get you to buy something. When really, I've had to have a shift in mindset, because I just want to get my message out there. And that's essentially what marketing is about. That I have this thing to offer, you know, in terms of the online courses and coaching services and consulting services that I really think will make a difference at tech companies. And that the only way for people to know about that is if I tell them about it, and through spreading the word as far and wide as possible that, hey, I exist. And also in terms of partnerships, that's also what I'm focused on too, that there's lots of people, yourself included, that are in a very similar space, whether it's serving the tech community or whether it's in the let's improve people processes in the workplace community, that we're all trying to achieve similar, if not the same outcomes, and we're not, let's not compete against one another, but let's figure out a way that we can gain points together instead of saying one of us is going to win and one of us is going to lose. Everyone can win. We're all winners. We can all be winners. That's something that came directly from the workshop, by the way. They're talking about it's not an either or. You know, it can't just be, oh, either I win or you lose, right? That we both can win. So those are the challenges that I'm going through right now.
That seems like a fundamental shift in the working world, which is kind of a more collectivistic approach, that it doesn't have to be such a polarized view of success, that we can collaborate. So I definitely understand where you're coming from.
Yeah. All right. So it's just about time to wrap things up. So thank you, Rob, my lovely co-host, and thank you to
Ben. I'm lovely.
You're the lovely co-host.
I think you're lovely, Rob.
And I'm the host. And thanks, Ben, for all of your thoughts tonight.
Yeah, thank you both. Thanks, Jen. Thanks, Rob.
Great.
Thanks, Ben.
Okay. And that wraps up another episode of the PeopleStack podcast. Check out my website, jenbunk.com. That's JenBunk.com, where you can find lots of goodies, including a link to PeopleStack Academy, my online school dedicated to helping the tech community build better people processes. Also on jenbunk.com, you can sign up for the Changelog, the PeopleStack weekly email with tips and exclusive offers only available to my email tribe. Thanks for listening. Bye for now.